Maybe you will be tired to listen about the methods too much, and then I present several interesting physical examples. I think it's interesting. Okay, what is diagrammatic Monte Carlo in short? So if one have some Hamiltonian, for example, Polaron is the simplest object which can be studied by the method, then one wants to calculate the green function, because green function contains a lot of information about the system. So it's very easy to write down the Feynman expansion in terms of the interaction representation. But the main thing is that by hand analytically we can sum up only several Feynman diagrams. So the diagrammatic Monte Carlo is a method which sums the Feynman expansion for systems in the thermodynamic limit for some cases without truncation of the Feynman series or any other approximation. So this method is exact. So assume you can write some kind of Feynman expansion, and then there is no problem of sign, which I tell later, then this Green function can be determined exactly. So I give a short list of problems which can be treated without approximation in this technique. So for example, there is an exciton. There is excited band, conduction band, valence band, and there is, in addition to the dispersion of the conduction and valence band, there is electron hole pair interaction. So what is important here is that, of course, we can treat this problem in so-called static screening approximation, because if I consider a narrow gap exciton, then already I have loops from the fermions, it's already many fermion problem. But until I have no such problem, so I can solve this problem exactly. And its solution is much better than the Bethe-Salpeter, because Bethe-Salpeter fails for the Vanier regime and this technique doesn't fail. This is now in progress. So one of my students now in Greifswald is Holger Feschke, and she is doing this problem. So it can be done, and now it's...
This is just two-particle Schrödinger
equation. Yes, two-particle Green function, yes. It can be solved in principle by Bethe-Salpeter, but if you use Bethe-Salpeter, then you cannot include also electron-phonon coupling. And also Bethe-Salpeter, because it uses the finite mesh of the k-points in the reciprocal space or in direct space, it cannot treat the Vanier limit, because one needs an infinite mesh of k-points to treat the Vanier limit. Yeah, of course. I thought this is bipolaron problem. I know. It was already done in this technique, not by me, but by one of our students, as MacReadin. Now this has been with Mark Jarrell in USA, so it was done already. The only problem. Yes, of course. Exists. So if you take two polarons, there is only one problem. So if we take two holes, for example, two particles, then and these particles are not attractive, this interaction is not attractive. No, they did it for on-site. But it can be done for many sites. It can be done for real column repulsion. Simply they were lazy. Okay, so one more thing which can be included, which cannot be included in other techniques, in the thermodynamic limit. So if I have the exciton, we can add the coupling to the boson bus. For example, it's phonons in this case. And this coupling can be diagonal with respect to bands as well as non-diagonal with respect to bands. It can be also included in this technique. And one more interesting thing which can be maybe somehow interesting for people who work with Yantele and pseudo-Yantele polarons. So if there is a Hamiltonian where particle is complex. So I mean that there are several internal states of the particle. It's either the states are degenerate or quasi-degenerate. It's like a Pseudian telepolaron. So in this case, this technique also works perfectly. Then it's trivially to introduce for the two-level system in the bosonic bed. So this is equation which is well known for physics of qubits. And in addition to two-level system, there is a coupling to the bus, which is noise bus, which has some signs. So I didn't do this problem, but it's very easy to do. No.
But this is spin boson domain, yeah?
Yeah, as soon as I think in terms of two-level system, already I have kind of...
You have many bosons, yeah? You have
many bosons.
Yeah.
One and two states.
Yeah, two states.
Yeah, so it's a two-level problem.
Two-level problem with bias. And this is, when it's coupled to bosonic bus, it's equivalent to the problem of one qubit. If there are several qubits, then it's really a problem with spins. Also, because spins commutation relations come into play, and I cannot write down so simple equation, it's already a problem. But with one qubit.
You design problem then, or no?
Yeah, it's the problem how to transform the spin commutation relations into this commutation relations of corresponding to several qubits. So spin are not so simply, if there are several spins, it's already difficult to make the expansion. The Feynman expansion is very complicated. Okay, with some approximation we can do also several qubits, but I'm not sure whether it will be relevant to the realistic system.
But your method is basically perturbation theory to all orders, right?
Yes.
But you cannot include this part for both, right?
Yes, I can. The problem is that all which I told you about now is in Q space. I can easily switch to the direct space, and in this case I can treat the hardcore bosons and also bipolarons. It's a problem to treat bipolaron in Q space because instead of attraction there is repulsion. But in direct space, this is not real interaction, so repulsion is diagonal term of expansion, so it's not interaction. So in this case one can treat also. So one of examples I show is the Monte Carlo in direct space.
If you're interested in looking for a non-trivial limit or a problem within the spin boson model, I would recommend that you look in this for the quantum phase transition in the sub-ohmic regime of that model.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very hard to get. As far as I know, perturbative approximations cannot access that. There's only the only technique I know can. There are this NRG approaches, which actually can detect these quantum phase transition, and you should get a critical coupling which is proportional to the exponent s when s goes to zero.
Is this problem outlined in the last Leggett review on?
It is. Yeah, the Leggett review misses that point because this one directing big approximation sends delta, the tunneling rate, to zero.
Mm-hmm.
And then this line collapses to zero coupling.
We have a
two-level system which can be representing whatever you want. We can have a qubit representing that, or for example, in a chemical reaction, a charge transfer reaction, we transfer one electron from one chemical reaction to another one, and that's coupling to a fluctuate.
But what kind of quantum transition?
It's a function of the coupling constant. So what you have, we know that for s equals 1, which is the ohmic regime, there is a phase transition between localization and delocalization, which is Kostolev-Staudt-like. When the coupling constant exceeds the critical coupling, the delta, the Hawking, is renormalized to 0. And therefore, if you prepare your system initially in one state, the coherent oscillations are absent. So it stays localized on one side. even though in the two-level system originally has a tunneling rate which can go. And so you have minimalization of the
constant.
And in the case when you have this critical value in dimensionless units is 1. And this critical cut, and if you go in the sub-ohmic regime when S is smaller than 1, that means you have a stronger coupling of the bosonic bar J of omega for smaller frequencies than for the ohmic ones. And then these critical coupling goes down, and secondly, you have really a quantum phase transition, which means that you have a new fixed quantum.
What is the open problem then? That's the only question.
The open problem is there any other method which can see this quantum phase transition than the numerical minimalization group?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
That's one open problem. And the second one is how does real-time evolution, if you start, you prepare a system in initial spin up, and you ask how does the spin decay as a function of time? What's the result there?
Yeah.
So that's a rather good question for the qubits.
Thanks, very good. Maybe later a little bit more discussion. Okay, these are some advantages of the method, but a lot of time spent for discussion, so I skip it. Okay, a little bit about the method. So which properties we are interested in. So if there is an exciton, of course, I am interested in two-particle green function. If there is a young telepolaron or the pseudo telepolaron, I am interested in matrix green function. And in case of polaron, I am interested in simple green function. And the problem is if I calculate the green function in imaginary time, as this method does, then it does not give me too much information until I get some information from it by making the analytical continuation. So this is a Lyman spectral function, and this is a measurable property. This is a property which gives a lot of information about system. And if I calculate this from diagrammatic Monte Carlo, then I need to solve this equation to get the Lyman function. This equation is very difficult to solve, but anyway, one needs to do this because it's rather general relation between the imaginary time and some spectral function. For example, for the Lehmann function, we have such kind of equation. But if we calculate some different properties, for example, for exciton, we calculate the two-particle Green function, and then we somehow find out by calculation such combination of the Green function. It's very easy to do. Then inverting equation with respect to this thing gives optical absorption by exciton. So it's a rather general thing. And for example, if we manage to calculate the current-current correlation function for polaron, then inverting the same equation, we just give the optical conductivity. So it's inverted equation, current-current correlation function divided by the frequency. Okay. So a little bit about the method. So I take the simplest example, which is the polaron, just to prevent a lot of diagrams. And this is expansion. If this is expansion is expanded, then we have sequence of different Feynman diagrams. And in terms of mathematical objects, it's nothing but infinite series of integrals with an ever-increasing order. So this function, so if we want to do some Monte Carlo with respect to the Feynman diagrams, we need to define some measure, some weight for Monte Carlo. So what is the weight for Monte Carlo? The weight for the Monte Carlo is very simple. So we have combination of the particle Green function and combination of the phonon Green function and the. So to get the weight which corresponds to the given term of the expansion, yes, we take the Bayer Green function of the particle, Bayer Green function of the phonons with corresponding moments and times, multiply by the vertexes, and this gives us the measure for which we can do Monte Carlo. So if this measure is positively definite, then okay, we can do this process. Then just giving an example, so this is the simplest diagram which can be drawn with electron-phonon coupling. So when the weight for this diagram of the second order is vertex squared, ring function of the phonons from tau 2 prime to tau 1 prime, which corresponding momentum q, and then product of three ring function which corresponds to this three diagram. So the same is for exciton. So for exciton, it's just the product of the whole pair's green function multiplied by the vertex. So nothing changed. So rules are very easy to implement. So someone should not be very skillful in the Feynman diagram technique to implement this calculation, because all diagrams are already written many years ago, and the problem is how to calculate this, how to sum up it. Then this is the question which you ask whether we can with phonons. So now it is in progress. It's also very easy to find out the weight for this thing. There is one more interesting thing which is good in this technique. So usually, if we think in terms that we have some Gamilton and we should sum up the Feynman diagrams, so we think that there is no interaction outside the Hamiltonian. But suppose we have a realistic system, there is some coupled object to the bosonic bus, and from the very beginning this object is not well defined. So because there are some interaction outside the Hamiltonian, interaction with another band. And what it gives us, that actually the dispersion relation exists only for non-interaction system. Because in real system, the spectrum is represented not by delta function, but by some spectral function which is already not delta function. And only for the case of non-interaction system, the spectral function just shrinks into the delta function, and this gives us dispersion relation. And if we have the Hamiltonian, which includes the objects, which are also interact by with some system which is not included into the Hamiltonian, still we can sum up this thing. Because in the usual case of the system where all interactions are included in the Hamiltonian, we have the rule that this is the green function for the particle, this is the green function for the phonon, and there are vertex. And this corresponds to the things where all quasi-particles which are defined by the bare Hamiltonian are non-interactive. But if we have another interaction which we can introduce through some imaginary self part, for example, anharmonicity of phonons, so nothing changes. So instead of the green function which we consider to be an exponent, simple exponent, non-interaction green function, we can include it to this technique, knowing real and imaginary parts of the quasi-particle, and nothing changed. We can still sum up, just to tabulate this function, and then still we are okay with the summation.
You have to have some kind of positivity condition. So your Fermion Green's functions, I always assume that you're looking at Green's functions in the vacuum, right? Otherwise, you have negative signs. And then
the green function, yeah. That was supposed to be somehow
positive, right. which it isn't.
Use the spectral function is proper.
If you just take free fermions and then put the chemical potential somewhere in the band, right? In this case,
first of all, it's Matsubara.
Let's understand what they want to say, that it doesn't matter if you have Hamiltonian, it's work fine. If you have action, you work with action. There is you expand around this Gaussian path, and this is this.
He's right.
Okay, but then where is the limitation to a few particles? Because you stated this at the beginning.
A few particles?
For instance, in Polaron problem.
Same problem.
For one particle, there is no same problem.
Yeah, but that's the thing. One particle, that's the question. Yeah. Right? If I have chemical potential in the middle of the band somewhere, I have many particles.
Yeah, it's already many particles.
Yeah.
But if there is one particle in the bottom of the band, then I do not see any limitation. I haven't found any.
No, but sure. The question asks me a question. If you have the chemical potential in the band, what happens?
So how do I see it in your formalism?
For one particle, chemical potential is minus infinity.
No, but the question is what happens for finite density?
Many fermions, you mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Many fermions is a sign problem. It's already...
So where does it show up in your formalism? Is that in the Green function?
You have to interchange the line probably of your...
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, no, there is no change in the line.
There is a sign problem in the fermion.
But still, yeah. I mean, you know, if you take three fermions with chemical potential in the middle of the band, you have many fermions in the ground state.
Right? Yeah. Once,
they do through the boson, they will interact.
It's limited to one fermion. It can treat many bosons, but for fermions,
sure.
It's usually same problem.
Okay, I believe what I said earlier was actually correct, but look at
all that. Leon, maybe is this whole problem of your representation. It works either in real space or in k-space, depends where the sign problem is.
Yeah.
Because sign problem is huge in k-space for three fermions, I agree.
Yeah.
But they go into real space.
For two fermions, it depends. If my interaction is repulsion, then I go into direct space. There's no longer interaction. It's diagonal term of Hamiltonian.
Yeah, sure.
But three fermions, many fermions, I'm sorry. We cannot.
But the technical requirement is you have to choose some basis when your Green's functions in tau space are positive.
Yeah.
Yes. In Matsubara representation, it's very easy. It's almost.
I'm sure it was correct.
How do you know beforehand your series converges? Yeah. So, for instance, in Polyvon, you have transitions here.
Yeah. Ah, you mean. Have to see that it is converged.
Yeah, even if it was for the right reason.
Okay, this is a great function of at the given imaginary.
No. This way it goes to real space. So the local Green function in real space is positive.
Please.
How do I see convergence? It's a Green function with a given length tau.
Mm-hmm.
And I can collect statistics of the order of Feynman diagram.
Mm-hmm.
This is the probability to have Feynman diagram of given order.
Mm-hmm.
So in strong coupling, there is a Gaussian peak at, so to say, n with a halfway root square of n.
Mm-hmm.
So if I, for example, this is 1,000,
mm-hmm.
and the width is root square from 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a reserve with a memory for, say, 3n maximum Feynman diagrams, it never reached. And if it reaches at once and say it's not convergent, I shift this.
So n grows somehow with tau, yeah? But for any tau, it's fine.
Yeah, it linearly grows with tau. So it's, of course, you understand that the density of the vertex per tau is the same for large tau for the asymptotic limit. Yeah, this is connected with the question you asked. So why Matsubara representation is necessary? Because in a positive function, and why I cannot represent the fermions? Because it's already a sign problem. Okay, so let me turn to the another problem. So we are great guys. We calculated the imaginary time Green function. We want to get the Lyman function or whatever, or optical conductive. And it's a so-called Fredmoll equation of the second type. And this equation was called ill-defined problem. So why it is ill-defined? So if I try to solve this equation by, for example, I generate some model spectral density and then I calculate some model Green function imaginary time and try to minimize the deviation from the actual Green function, which I get from Monte Carlo by least square fit. So I end up with a solution which has sawtooth noise. So for example, yellow line is the actual spectrum. And if I solve naively this equation, then I get such solution. So delta function is okay. And then instead of the smooth spectral density, I have terrible spikes. And this is called the sawtooth noise instability. And have to find this sawtooth noise instability, it was found in early 50s by two great guys, Phillips and Tikhonov from Moscow University. And the solution was the following. So I want to suppress this noise to get the realistic solution. And what I do, so in addition to this equation, I add some functional which depends on derivatives, first derivatives, second derivatives. And this functional is of kind that I suppress large derivatives. And if this derivative is suppressed, then okay, in the smooth path I have the smooth thing. But what is wrong with this technique, which is called regularization technique, and maximal entropy method is one of the 100 variants of the regularization technique. It gives that this thing is no longer sharp, because large derivatives are suppressed, and this is no longer the delta function. So if one really wants to study some kind of gaps, then the method of the regularization, including the maximal entropy method, doesn't work. And the question was how to defeat this sawtooth noise without regularization. And the idea appeared to be very stupid. So let me do the following. So my desire is to introduce some model solution and then make it as close as possible to the real spectrum. And for example, I introduce some measure of deviation, which is just I take this model solution and calculate the Green function and then calculate the distance of the Green function from the Green function I got from Monte Carlo, and I make it to do as close as possible. So let me start from such kind of configuration, so my model function is reproduced by rectangles. And then I start to fit the Green function by making the following thing. I initiate the initial configuration of rectangulars by random number generator. So for example, random number 100 is number of rectangulars, its position, so height, width, everything is generated by random number generator. And then I introduce this measure, so I take this model function, I'll calculate the model Green function, and I calculate this deviation from the actual Green function, and I try to minimize this measure by doing following possible updates. So I can shift the rectangulars, I can change the height of the rectangular, just making it narrower and higher. I can change the number of rectangulars, so just splitting this rectangular or gluing it back. And what I get in the end will be non-regularized solution. And the interesting thing that, of course, this solution is non-regularized, so it has sawtooth noise. We ended up with the thing which we fought with. But then I generate next solution. So again, I start with a random number generator configuration and then minimize it. So what happens if I sum up this statistically independent non-regularized solution, then the sawtooth noise self-averages. So when I show you example how it goes. Okay, so this is the model function is a delta function with some weight, half of the spectral weight, and three angle. So it's initially taken, intentionally taken three angle because there is an infinite first derivative. And this is how spectrum looks after I sum up four non-regularized solutions, but which each one is statistically independent. So it looks like in this way when I sum up 28 non-regularized solutions. And it looks like nearly ideal after I sum up 500 non-regularized solutions. So you see that this delta function is not broadened. This gap is perfectly reproduced, and even the infinite first derivative is reproduced. So, and this example, which is difficult to believe that it's possible to restore such kind of spectrum with maximal entropy or other kind of regularization. So there's a big spectral density in the range of, say, 2. And there is here, it's not shown here, it's shown here where the scale is blow up. There is a micro gap of the size of 0.01, very small size. And then there is very small gap. And I would like to restore the spectrum, including the high energy part and this micro gap, which is here. And you see that it perfectly works. So I can do this. It's difficult to imagine to make it by regularization method. There are some examples which we compared. Of course, I cannot do it myself. I should some independent guy to check it. And it's my special thanks to Ole Gunnarsson, who made this check recently. So they said, they call it statistical sampling. I call it statistical optimization method. It doesn't matter, they just use the method which was advertised to you. And they say that for the problem started here, the statistical method itself has advantage that it needs no default model, because the maximal entropy, I should have a guess about the initial spectrum and then I can calculate. But with this setup, I don't need a guess. I just calculate from the bare sheet. And gives slightly better results than maximal entropy using quite accurate default model. So even if I almost know in MEM the result, then still this method, which does not need initial guess, gives still better results. And that's maybe all I wanted to tell about the method. It's published some places. So if there are some questions about method, if there is no noise, I transfer to physical examples. To one physical example, I think. This time left is for one. Okay. This problem, it's special thanks to Daniel Chomsky, because I thought of this problem 20 years, because after I read his review about the mixed valence in Soviet physical oscillation. And the problem is the following. Okay, we know there is phantom dome principle in optical spectroscopy. So if I have electronic configuration 1 and at light distance and energy electronic configuration 2, and there is experimental time, which is Planck constant divided by delta E. And then if this time is faster than the Fonon characteristic time, then I can think about the transition from the from the lattice, which is frozen in the initial configuration, to the lattice, which is frozen. So during the transition of the electrons, there is no change of the lattice. It's frozen. It's Frankendon approximation. And then the question is, it is okay when I have apparently different two electronic levels. But what I do if I have the optical connectivity if polarized, whether the Frankendon principle is valid or not valid. Because I have no apparently two differences of two levels. I have just transition which change the lattice. So if I have some polaron, it has some transition which change the lattice. And okay. Let's skip. And first we did, we calculated the optical conductivity, so this is the data of the optical conductivity of polaron, starting from weak coupling limit to light decoupling limit. Comparison with some theory 10 years old, which happened to be not correct. So what we decided to do, so after we get this data, we made two following things. First, using the memory function technique, we approximately calculated the optical conductivity, taking into account the lattice relaxation. So this means that all transition in the system in this theory goes adiabatically. So we have the Frankendon principle is not valid. And if our data coincides with exact Monte Carlo data, then there is no validity of Frankendon principle because we take every well of the vortices adiabatically. And then we did the second thing. We calculated the same optical conductivity using Frankendon principle. So we keep the lattice frozen. And then we calculate how it looks like. So here's a black line. Is the data where we treat the lattice adiabatically. You see this quite reasonable description of the peak, at least the peak position. But then if we come to some critical alpha, and this is alpha 8.5, I do not know how it can be distinguished, because transition to the strong coupling unit is alpha 6, something like that. But then we see that this solution already deviates. It's the splitting from the peaks. And if we go to larger alpha, it deviates completely from the adiabatic coupling. But then we compare it with the theory when we calculated the optical response in the Frank-Condon approximation. And then we see that it perfectly fits. So if we look at this picture, sorry?
I mixed up. Which is which here?
This is adiabatic, and this is Frank-Condon. So if you look at the dependence on the peak position on alpha, then this has a Monte Carlo data. So this line corresponds to the adiabatic description. And this dotted line corresponds to the Frank-Condon description. So the first peak follows the adiabatic prediction. Then it doubles some alpha. And then it comes finally to the Frank-Condon description. And what we wanted to do is just to understand why it happens, the physical. So you understand that Monte Carlo is a numeric experiment. You got the result, but you don't know the reason. You know the result is exact, but you don't know the reason again. So what we wanted to do is to understand what's going on.
What is adiabatic, optical conductivity calculated by adiabatic?
When I calculate the current operator, yeah. I think that whenever I change the lattice, electron adiabatically follows. So its electron is much faster than the lattice.
So you integrate the electrons out and get effective Hamiltonian operators.
Yes. So whenever for any electronic configuration, the lattice is adjusted. It is adiabatic. And Frank-Condon, when I change the electronic configuration, but lattice stay in the same place as if it is very fast change, and lattice cannot react. And okay, so we try to understand what's going on.
But somehow I always thought that adiabatic and perturbative regime are kind of opposite to each other. But you say that you have agreement with adiabatic for small alpha, actually.
Sorry?
I thought that perturbative regime, when you can treat electron lattice interaction perturbatively, yeah, is kind of opposite to adiabatic regime, yeah?
Perturbative, what do you mean?
In the first approximation, neglect interaction between electron and lattice, and then, add it up, as a correction.
In case of adiabatic interaction, so the thing I have is that whenever I have electronic configuration, then I have the frozen lattice. And then I consider the electron, which is in frozen lattice. This is adiabatic approximation. And Frank-Condon is when I change the position of the energy of energy state of the electronic subsystem, then the lattice system cannot react on this. Okay. So what is characteristic time of experiment is time which is h divided by delta e. And then what I need to compare with this characteristic time. If I have the adiabatic approximation, then what I have is the function of, I say, the ground state, and this is excited state. And excited state is, say, the state which corresponds to the maximum of peak of optical conductivity. So in the ground state, I have some coefficients, so this is the adiabatic green function. This is lattice green function, wave function. This is lattice green function, and this is electron wave function. And if the adiabatic approximation is correct, then these two different things are not coupled by non-adiabatic operator. So honestly, if I introduce some kind of adiabatic function, then I need to make the system of equation which has non-diagonal terms, which is non-adiabatic correction due to non-adiabatic operator. So if I have the some mixing between different non-adiabatic states, then I can introduce the characteristic time for the non-adiabatic interaction, which is 1 over average value of this operator. And then I need to introduce some measure. So I want to understand whether this process corresponds to the thing when my adiabatic operator connects very well to the states, or it's weak enough to connect these two states. Then the maximum thing which can happen with two levels is when all these two round and excited states are completely overmixed by the adiabatic and the non-adiabatic operator. And the maximum we can get is when it's 1 over root square over 2, 1 over root square 2, and this is 1. So we call it the measure of the adiabatic process. And then Frank-Condon process is defined as a 1 minus Frank-Condon. And then if we introduce such measure and take the simplified formula for the non-adiabatic operator, so we got very compact formula, which corresponds to the Frank-Condon component of the response, which is depends on ratio of experimental on and interconfigurational time. And then if we look at the result, we see that right without any fitting parameters, that right at the value of something like 8, we have switch from the adiabatic, so from the intensity of the adiabatic process to the Frank-Condon process, which is in principle correspond to the exact Monte Carlo result we have. So I want to thank you for attention. So this was only one physical example, but I hope it was enough. Thank you for attention.
I was actually kind of hoping to hear the last topic that we talked about,
yes,
the phonon and the way that recuperates.
Right.
I don't know if there are other people are interested in that.
Yes. You said something about that before, right?
Okay. What is seen in cuprates? So we can measure as RPS von Arndorff cuprates, which corresponds to the spectral function of Mann particle in the TJ model. Then if you make any kind of theoretical calculation, then for pi half wave vector, which is the ground state of the TJ model, always the sharp peak is delta function of peak, which somehow has some dispersion. But whenever we do a look at an experiment, it's always very broad.
This is again one particle.
Yes, it's single particle because RPS of Arndorff system corresponds to the single particle system. So within the TJ model, one cannot explain this because pi half is the ground state of the system, so there's no decay process.
So the lowest energy in the experiment is a pi/2.
Pi half.
So
and we see that the distortion of the TJ band is much smaller than the width of the peak, so it's overdumped. So the width of the peak is much larger than the distortion itself, k dependent of the average. So what we try to do, we try to include phonon. At first, this idea seems to be stupid because it's known from theory that the dispersion of this broad peak can be perfectly reproduced by TJ model. So if I try to make some broadening by phonons, then this dispersion will be also violated, and this happens to be not true in the strong coupling regime. So keeping something. So this is a spectral function of one hole without electron phonon coupling. So I increase electron phonon coupling, and this is pi half ground state point. And what I get finally for the strong coupling, and this strong coupling is okay. I need much smaller coupling constant than in case of two-dimensional Holstein model because it's already there is narrowing of the K band.
What are all the peaks in the G equals zero?
Sorry?
Why so many peaks?
It's the string resonance. It's a remnant from the string resonance.
Okay, you do have those. coupling to magnums.
Yeah, of course. So for TJ Z models, they are very well pronounced, but for T, due to quantum fluctuation. But still, if I look at the scaling scales when J goes to zero, like real string resonance.
So you're doing some kind of consistent one approximation?
For magnums, it's self-consistent one. For phonons, I calculated exactly. Because, yeah, but again, thanks to Ole Gunnarsson, who checked that this is good approximation.
No, we know that the
self-consistent
one approximation is very good.
Okay, so we increase the coupling constant, and finally we have this small Polaron peak of the real quasi particle. And this is the broad Chekhov Frank-Condon peak, as it's called. Then.
Dimensionless, coupling constant is dimensionless.
Dimensionless, of course. So it's J is lambda is twice, so lambda is 0.5. So for Holstein Polaron, you need lambda 1 to turn to the strong coupling regime, and here you need much smaller lambda. Okay, and if I look at the momentum dependence of this broad peak, then of course this small peak is frozen. There is almost no momentum dependence because it's small Polaron.
This is a, Einstein
Polaron? Holstein. In principle, we can anyone, but it was the simplest thing to start with. Okay, but dispersion of this peak perfectly reproduces the dispersion of the TJ band without interaction to phonons. So this means that I gain the width of the peak, which is much larger than this dispersion, but I do not change the dispersion. And okay, you can try any coupling regime, but it's always in the strong coupling regime, this is very robust property. There is a band of Polaron with very, very small weight, 10 to the minus 4, is difficult to see by ARPAS. But then this broad peak perfectly disperses, reproducing the TJ module without coupling to phonons. And then after that, okay, some explanation for this, no time.
Let's see what it means.
Physically, it's again thanks to Ole Gunnarsson, third time, who just after we did it, he said it's very easy physical explanation. So if we have coupling to the, if we have transition from ground state to excited state, and there is a coupling to phonons only in excited state, because first, before ARPAS process, we have field band, no holes. Then we take away some hole and hole is coupled to phonons. So we have situations when only final state has coupling to phonons. Because initial state, there is no hole, no coupling. And then, okay, this is the ground state, which corresponds to Q square over 2 is a configurational diagram. This is excited state without coupling to phonons. Then we add the coupling to phonons in adiabatic approximation, and we can rewrite it in the following way. This means that this parabola in excited state is shifted. So it is shifted, but when we have transition at zero temperature, at small temperature, from the center of the ground state to this band, we see that this energy doesn't change in principle in adiabatic approximation. So whatever you do in adiabatic approximation of for small omega frequencies in comparison with T of with J, it's always the same.
I would say it's Frank-Condon actually.
Is it there, Frank-Condon?
Because you go to the tuning point, classical tuning point. You know?
Yeah, it's not me, it's Gunnar. And and the second is there is a some rule for the spectral function. If I started from the Polaron which has for any k, sorry, any k, any moment, you started from the Polaron with some dispersion and you add up the strong electron phonon coupling, then the Polaron itself is a very narrow band, very low, with very small spectral weight. So all spectral weight in this Frank-Condon peak, also spectral weight is here, and then according to this some rule, this spectral weight must be this must have the same k dependence as the original particle.
So what is the phonon frequency typically in terms of J? For example?
Frequency was 3 times smaller than J, like an experiment.
0.1
in units of T and 0.3 units of J. Okay, then after looking at this picture, you could say to me that, okay, it's okay. But if you dope system a little bit, then the chemical potential should be not on the quasi-particle, which is measured by ARCOS. Because if this is real quasi-particle, if I dope system a little bit, the chemical potential just sits on this quasi-particle. And you should have, if you have such structures, there is small peak here, so the chemical potential should be separated by this quasi-particle, which is in an ARCOS. And okay, that was proved maybe half of a year after our paper. The exchange group from Stanford made such kind of experiment, and they found that for undoped system, the chemical potential is well separated from the quasi-particle. So when they doped system, the chemical potential, but it's still always separated from the quasi-particle which is observed. So from this we can say that at least for undoped cuprates, there is a strong electron-phonon coupling, as we can judge from this spectroscopy. So we can even claim some kind of quantitative agreement. So this is the experiment, and this is theoretical description. And then you see this very nice one-to-one correspondence of these two pictures. And if you measure, for example, calculate or measure the difference between the bandwidth, width of this peak, and its width of pi half, which is the narrowest peak, then okay, we see that there is a theoretical prediction, there is experimental prediction, so we can claim that for small lambda, it's for no dope cuprates.
How unique is this interpretation? Okay, fine, phonon can do it, but does it really prove that it's entirely phonon? Because couldn't it be that, for instance, interpretation can do more or less the same things also in the growing?
Spin fluctuation are very strongly
independent.
There is only one.
You picked up your.
There is only one experimental proof. One should measure the isotope effect in undoped compounds with ARC. But this is very difficult. So far, people cannot prepare good specimens for this. Because I have only this indication. So if you have more 5 minutes, then I tell you that it's not, or maybe some people who are interested can discuss it later. Okay, we are a little bit surprised. So many years people tell that there is no electron-phonon coupling in superconductors, but now we suppose that there is. And then we need to know whether it's, what is lambda doping dependence? Of course, with a technique which corresponds to one particle, we cannot rigorously solve this problem. But what we can do? We know, this is not, we assume this is really true, that the spectral function measured by ARPES is a one particle property of many particle system. It's one particle Lehmann function. And then let me think that the other particles in the main field approximation screen the electron-phonon coupling. So, and then, assuming such picture, we take an experiment and try to determine effective electron-phonon coupling dependent on doping. So how we do it? Okay, this is experimental data, it's famous kink in cuprates. So crosses correspond to the so-called MDC analysis, momentum distribution curve. And circles correspond to EDC analysis, because in Monte Carlo the spectral function with the EDC analysis. But it doesn't matter, we see that this kink. MDC is you keep momentum fixed. Sorry, EDC. You keep momentum fixed, and then you look at your peak, which you see,
energy distribution curve.
And MDC is vice versa. You fix energy, and then you look. But it gives different results for strongly correlated system, you see. It's only for delta function, is okay. Okay, what we see is that as soon as we increase doping, these things get smaller. So, and then comparing our Monte Carlo data for kink, we would like to see what happens. This is LASCO, LSCO. Okay, this is our Monte Carlo calculation of the kink. and it's okay. So when I showed this picture to Alexandra Lanzara, she asked me, is it theory or experiment? I said, no, it's theory. It's very similar to experiment, but it's theory. But the main thing is that we can calculate the King angle for different coupling lambda. And then we see that it's okay for several, our calculation fits to some specific curve. And then we, having this numeric relation, that the V high is high energy velocity minus V low, low energy velocity divided by V low is equal to 20 lambda square, so it's numeric. We can determine lambda from the king, just making fit of the experiment. And what we get is the following thing. Yes, it's true that lambda is very light for undoped compounds. But when we increase doping, it decreases. So it's comparison of our Monte Carlo real experiment. We cannot do this by, for example, Eliasbeck theory, because Eliasbeck theory gives me lambda equal 20. So it's already, crystal should blow up. So, but why? Because it's very weak coupling theory.
But what would you
keep
by that? Would you try to fit in
the transition? We can obtain fit in LR, we can obtain kink in Eliasbeck theory. But to fit
that. But then you would need another 20, yeah?
Yes.
But 20 is not an average.
It cannot be. It should be blow up on the crystal then, dissociate. With this kind of analysis, we have lambda 1, but you see that whatever we do is, so it's undoped, so it's EDC analysis, so it's MDC, and this is, by the way, is a value which was obtained by Horst Kaliulin when they fit the phonon spectral renormalization and broadening, so it's more or less consistent. And there is one more thing which we can say from the optical conductivity. Okay, in optical conductivity, there is famous mid-infrared peak, which was so many things, and okay. People who looked many times, many years on this data. Mid-infrared. Okay. This is also mid-infrared. This peak people claim also mid-infrared, so it's rather ancient papers. So if you look at the modern paper, it's already well pronounced. So people imagine for many years that they see the mid-infrared peak, but finally now with new experimental techniques they can really see.
Maybe that's a different
peak. Oh, it's everywhere, in LASCO, in YBCO, it's everywhere. And people tried to explain it by TJ model, also by TJ model. And if one calculates TJ model, and many people did it, and then there is a peak on 2G. And people say, okay, maybe this peak is correspond to the mid-infrared peak, which is seen in experiment. But there was several contradictions. So in experiment, the mid-infrared energy is 0.5 electron volt. And whenever you do these parameters in the theory, it's 2 times smaller. So it's one contradiction. Second contradiction with this peak is in experiment, the mid-infrared energy decreases with doping. So you increase the doping and mid-infrared energy goes down. But in theory, if you increase the number of holes, at least in several papers, I see that it goes to the higher energy. Am I right?
I don't remember exactly what we
used. That's a picture from the paper. So we ask whether it can be looked by phonons, made by phonons. Okay, first about technique. So it was studied by self-consistent Born approximation, exact regionalization. So in self-consistent, they see two peaks at lower energy, but nothing in high energy. With exact regionalization, they see something at 2J and one more structure on the high energy. It's TJ without phonon. We just want to check the technique whether it works. But what we see all the peaks. So it means that the resolution of our message is much better. We see the first peak, second peak, and also this peak, which is not seen in self-consistent Brown approximation. So we can distinguish all the peaks. So what's interesting, it starts when we add the phonons, is that we get this show. This is no phonons, and we increase electron-phonon interaction. Of course, this peak shifts, but there is additional structure which appears here. And if we look carefully at the experiment, this structure was seen also many times. And in recent experiment, it was perfectly. So this means that at least on the level of appearance of this shoulder in theory and experiment, we have some electron-phonon coupling. And then we try to understand what is the value of this coupling, making the same stupid thing as I told you with Lehmann function. We think that there is effective lambda, and there is screened by other particles. And then we can compare in theory and experiment. So this is the position of the main peak in the optical conductivity, and this position is also known in experiment. So comparing this position in experiment and in theory, we can get an effective coupling lambda. And also, if you look at the effective coupling lambda in LASCO, it has nearly the same dependence which we determined looking at the ARPs. Okay, YBCO is different, but it is because of reason that when I dope YBCO, not all poles go into plane, some go into chains. But if I make everything in terms of holes which go in two planes, then I see that for LASCO, lambda, electron-phonon lambda determined from optical conductivity, and in YBCO it's more or less universal. So it goes to rather small, already moderate, from strong to moderate values at the doping of the plane 0.2. But then if I consider the lambdas which are determined from the optical conductivity, LASCO and YBCO, and compare it with lambdas I determined for the optical conductivity from the King angle, I see there is a very good correspondence between these two analyses. So
you look at the lambda which you would put, for instance, in BTS,
If it would be due to phonons, but I always do reservation, it has nothing to do with the mechanism of supercomputer. Absolutely nothing.
If you are some there to claim. Then please use
these values. Yes. But you see that whatever I do when I increase doping, then from different, absolutely different things, from the optical conductivity or from ARPs, I see that lambda goes down from the strong to moderate values. And that's all I wanted to say about electron-phonon coupling.
Could you say from point of view of zero, what is the main mechanism of the zero normalization to zero lambda? Is just the density of states goes down?
We cannot many particle function, but okay, I think it is screening of electron-phonon coupling.
But that was your assumption, actually, not the
yes, of here. Course. I told you that I consider this lambda, that all other particles are present via the mean field, and then I compare with experiment, I try to fit. And then I get this result both from optical conductivity and King angle, I have the same result. And there is one more way to determine this lambda. And as I remind you, there is a separation of the quasi of this particle, of this peak from the real chemical potential. And one can calculate this separation also. And also this method gives basically the same values for lambda. So I use three methods to calculate lambda and always see the same picture that it behaves in the following way. It's strong at small coupling, at low doping, and then it goes to moderate values at optimal doping. So maybe it's not good for people who claim electron-phonon explanation for the superconductivity.
But again, I mean, this is all with TJ plus the phonon, right?
Sometimes TT prime, T double prime. So we studied also T prime, T double. What we found for T prime, T double prime, so there is such things. If I need transform into the strong coupling between the host and polaron into dimension, I need lambda 1. If I transform the TJ model with the same parameters, say J equals 0.3, I need 0.4. So I need smaller coupling. But if I take the parameters which people use to fit the spectra in K prime, K double prime, J models, then I need 0.6. So there is such kind of difference for the coupling constant. Of course, this is the narrowest one, narrowest band, and then it's easy to transform into strong coupling clearly. So when I calculate for the TJ model, then I need to simply make the scaling from lambda, from this lambda to this lambda, it's 1.5. Just to.
So what is the energy that gives you the separation between the true chemical potential and the pseudo quasi particle P? Is that, does it go like the Fermi frequency or something?
Yeah, it's something like 0.4 electron volts, it's in an experiment.
That in the theory, what is
the same?
Yeah, but how does it go? I mean, it scale like the Fermi frequency or?
Distance is proportional to lambda. Distance from, okay. In the strong coupling limit, the polaron spectral function is just some small, this is a small z factor real quasi particle. And then this function don't shake off peak. And this distance is proportional to lambda. And this is the position of the chemical potential.
Lambda times J.
No, lambda is lambda times t. Okay, any parameter you use from energy is proportional to lambda. Lambda t or lambda j, whatever you like, simply different coefficients.
What do you do to spins? I mean, so when you do calculation at large x, yeah. So what happens to your spin background? You still solve one whole problem, right?
Yeah, I told you. Of course, I cannot study anything except one whole problem.
But
you can say that it's not already good to look at the system. Okay, so then I take responsibility only for this part.
Okay.
So don't look at this.
So you still have, you know, the same spin state as before.
Yeah. What experiment tells us, there is no already interferometer. Mm-hmm. But if you look carefully at neutral magnetic scattering data, there is still strong short-range spin correlations. So what we need to look at the whole from the antiferromagnetic, because everything is within the plucket, electron phonon coupling, spin flips. So what we need is a short range spin correlation. Of course, it's not true. So basically what I do, I just take the antiferromagnetic ground state, put holes there, and then study. Of course, there is no antiferromagnetism at all. But what we need for this problem with short range coupling is strong correlations on near neighbors.
Yes, I mean, two questions. I mean, do you have any idea what kind of phonon you are looking at in the experimental system? And,
if I can see any difference.
Supposed
to be okay, half breathing. I never asked this question when I did this work because I didn't know that something happens interesting from that. Just hold the phone and push the button.
Sorry, but about this screening that you are talking about, so how would you explain this screening mechanism so that you get into this smaller and smaller interactions while you put more doping? So how do you think about that?
I know only one guy who explained me immediately. It's Jan Zanen.
It's clear if you look at
plasmon, some kind of plasmon, I don't remember which one, and then make it dependent on doping, and this is the phonon frequency, then we see that somehow when we dope, it very quickly crosses this phonon frequency, and then this gives you the screening. So it's plasmon, it's already screened electron phonon. It's Jan Zanen. So please catch him.
Let me ask another evil question. What would this order do to your system now?
What is what?
This order do to your system? I mean, is there any way you can...
You can see that on the very local program, so...
Yeah, no, I understand that. But I mean, if you have this order, then already on your previous...
I want to study this function with defects, with impurities. Simply, I turned into the direct space and then...
Yeah, sure. But I mean, in these small, you know, quickly built compounds, I mean, I'm not relatively sure that my mass is all in there. So, I mean, there's some problem.
But what do you say?
There would be some problem in any system. Independent of the performance.
So, recently, I saw Sasha Alexandrov, who explained me everything, what happened with defects, just if I have to find. Okay. If there are defects, the problem is that these defects, as claimed, are shallow defects, not deep defects, shallow defects. And within this shallow defects, there is, of course, sometimes, especially with a strong electron-phonon coupling, there is a bound state. And this bound state, because effect is shallow, is very extended. And if you calculate the matrix element of the alpha scattering on this shallow state, and this extended state, and then it's like in neutron spectroscopy, there is a form factor. And when there is a form factor of the extended state, it's very, very localized in the Q space. So you see it for small Q. By half, and you don't see it for logic. And then the prediction of Sasha Alexandrov was that if we look at the coherent part, so you see this is the peak which corresponds to the incoherence Frank-Condon shift, and this is coherent Frank which is observed by the exchange group from Stanford. So prediction of Sasha Alexandrov was that only very near to pi half, because of this extended state due to defects, you can see the signal. But if you very far from pi half, you cannot see. And this actually is in an experiment.
Once again, how unique is this explanation? Because in principle, actually, a very common knowledge that you have well-defined value part of one, you talk to pi half, everything goes away from it, whether due to wide effects. Why do we need effects like that?
I need defects.
No, but why is the explanation? Your explanation is that it's only well defined by half, that relies on these, what you told us, the very shallow theory.
Ah, it's, you mean Sasha Alexandrov, okay.
Alexandrov. Would you get something like that also without any? Also, well defined.
Only nearly
pi half. Pi half, and everything is blown in the right direction. I think it's everywhere in every experience.
Yeah, you know, there's in high PC for any question you have. 10 unique explanations, all of them are different. And maybe, basing from the results of UT seminar, we can say that sometimes in moments and multiplets, there are at least 3 different explanations, which are always unique. So in this sense, my explanation is as unique as any other one. But up to now, I do not know anyone who explained me the correct position of the middle Fourier band in the optical conductivity is dot independence, and explain why this is so broad. So it is unique in the sense that we can explain several experimental facts which are not explained.
I'm asking just specifically as to the role of impurity, that you kind of rely with electronic Sasha, but I don't see why. Previously, that's why.
You should catch Sasha Alexandrov and ask him. Okay, at least it does not contradict the experiment, his explanation.
Yeah.
And how it is unique, because Patrick Lee has another explanation for for this fact that only near pi half due to confinement, deconfinement. I do not understand really what he told, but he said that there is a unique explanation for this fact that from here we can see only near pi half.
But maybe to come back to the question of the shift of this fake, what you call fake quasi particle, maybe you can relate the shift to the mid-infrared, the position of the mid-infrared band. No? I mean, they should go together. So maybe you can make a prediction. I mean, maybe they scale the same way. Can you take the ratio, for example, of the shift in the position of the
medium current? At least what I can see that I see when I extract lambda from the shift of the mid-infrared band and extract lambda from the kink angle and extract lambda from the distance of the broad peak from the chemical potential. For all these three things, I have the same lambda dependence from x. So in this sense,
maybe the ratio is kind of universal for lambda big enough.
Yeah. Okay. Telling it in more details. Here I can determine the absolute value of lambda by the shift by the kink angle. In this case, I can determine the ratio lambda x to lambda zero. But if I see that at least these two figures are congruent, then taking this value, I can say that there is the same absolute value. So of course, here I determine only lambda x to lambda x equals zero. And also, I'm not responsible for this part, only for low. And then the tendency is clear.
Nick, I want to ask you a question that earlier part. When you discovered Franconden and non-Franconden, yes. And then there was a discovery of the bike, and then there was kind of feeding. What is actually going on in the feeding? It looks like in your curve you get some one curve, and that's what you can simply reproduce. Fine, it's not. So you can say, for instance, with alpha going, say, below 5, you can say one curve, and say above, say, 12, you get another curve, and close to, say, 8 and 7, you get two sets of, say, data. What is it? So we have simultaneously two kind of,
It means that the matrix with changing intensity. So if from this simple theoretical estimate, I have that adiabatic processes goes to zero, and Van Condon intensity goes up.
But it's not simply that the situation kind of does something in between, but it really has two possibilities, two separate pieces.
Yeah, I was surprised. I never believed in analytic continuation, but I tried hard to get rid of these two peaks, and whenever I get the better data, the more pronounced these two peaks were, so I cannot get rid of these two peaks.
It looks as though there are kind of two solutions, I can say, we change this and two.
Yeah, looks like.
It's not the ground state, it's an excited state.
Yes, it's transition from the ground state to excited state, say.
Yeah, but these two different things, can we attribute them to two different final states?
Simply speaking, yes. So what we did, we calculated it, the response in the memory function technique, just adjusting lattice, so it always was a diabatic approximation. And second, the calculation was in the Franck-Condon approximation. And what we did, we tried to fit this peak position. So it fits good for small alpha and fits good for another solution, fits good for larger alpha. But in between, we see two peak structures. It can be doubt in our theory, but these are data from Monte Carlo. I don't see that we have any mistake.
But shouldn't you, at some limit, see, you know, several peaks, like, you know, you excite this one, you know, this two corner?
It's already very broad, you see. So maybe there are many. Of course, every peak is not one state, it's a group of states.
It looks like you have one kind of zero-phonon line, or more or less
anti-clockwise. Zero-phonon line is here.
Ah, that,
I'm not
here.
It's here, so... If I go back to...
Why didn't they get...
Okay, it's recoupling, it's here. So zero-phonon line is... It's already strong coupling, so zero phonon line is present.
Good.
I'm sorry for speaking so long.
No, that's fine. You check here. Okay?